Okay, so again, I'm hoping you're able to see the board. If you can't see the board, you're going to miss out some things. I want to tell you why my goals for speaking now. I have two goals. First of all, I think it's important. You know, very soon, we're going to be celebrating with thousands of other people in the heart of Yerushalayim. And I think it's important to just share what we are celebrating. And why we said Hallel this morning, and why we're celebrating now. And I want to do that really in two ways, and they're going to happen kind of simultaneously. One, I thought it would be important to share the history, the geography, some of the military victories from June 1967. But intertwined with that, part and parcel of that, is to the best of our abilities to share in a really brief way God's hand 49 years ago. And they go hand in hand. It's almost impossible to talk about God's hand without seeing what he did. But it's also almost impossible to see what people did 49 years ago without seeing God's hand. There is a story that I've been trying to verify. I haven't been able to verify, but many people quote the story. If you are an American Army officer, you go to a place called the West Point Military Academy. Is that what it's called? Yeah. West Point. It's located about 45 minutes north of Muncie, about an hour and a half north of Manhattan, in a beautiful New York State. And if you want to be an officer in the United States Army, you have to go there. There's Jews there, whatever it is. They say that among all the things that you learn how to do physically, there's also a lot of lectures, of course, and one of the lectures, a series of lectures, is military victories around the world. What can we, the United States Army, learn from military victories around the world? The story goes that one of the battles that they must learn if you want to be an American officer is the Six-Day War, 1967. And they learn. The soldiers did this, and the Air Force did this, and the tanks did that. And a lot of the things that I'm going to say is what they learn. But the story goes that at some point in the middle of the lecture, as part of the curriculum, they do say that the amount that we can learn from the war in the Middle East in June 1967, we can't learn everything. Because much of the Jews' victory is inexplicable by regular military history. They are saying in army speak that there is gaps between what happened, in other words, what the armies did, and the victory. Because what they're saying is, I understand it to be God's hand. And so we're going to talk about the geography, we're going to talk about the military, but we've got to talk about God's hand in between. Number one, we've got to start by putting it in perspective. When you talk about the Six-Day War, you and I grew up, and I did also. I grew up, my name is Yamin. My first name is Yamin. I was born, now you know how old I am, I was born a couple of weeks, about 10 days after the Six-Day War was over. And my family and so many people in the world were so enthused that my family called me Yamin, Yamin Hashem Osachayel. And so I too grew up in a world of post-Six-Day War. So we say Six-Day War since we're born. But wars are not supposed to last 6 days. It doesn't happen. There's no such thing. There's a battle, maybe, but there is no such thing as a war that takes 6 days. And I remember very clearly being the assistant principal in an elementary school in New York in the beginning of the second Persian Gulf War. And I remember the principal there, Rabbi Joel Cohn, got up on the sixth day of that war. I think I have my history right, but on the sixth day of that war, maybe it was Afghanistan, I think it was that war, on the sixth day after Tfilah, eighth grade, he always gave little Divrei Torah, and one of the things he said that day was, guys, today is the sixth day of this war. And the armies involved weren't even fully ready for the war, in that war. And you expect, nobody's expecting a war to be over in 6 days. So before we do anything, before we say anything, we have to recognize that a war is not supposed to last 6 days. People are supposed to die in wars. Many people are supposed to die in wars, and that's only in the first few months. We have wars that are lasting for more than 3,000 days. The American Revolutionary War, more than 3,000 days. The American Civil War, almost 1,500 days. World War II lasted more than 2,000 days. More than 2,000 days. And here we are, sort of a ho-hum, six-day war. Putting in perspective. A second piece of perspective. I don't know if you guys can see down here, but I'm going to read whatever's on the board here. On Yom Ha'atzmaut, 1967. Okay, that's pre-Six-Day War. You and I celebrated Yom Ha'atzmaut already, right? So this is on Yom Ha'atzmaut of 1967, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkas Harav, he was the son of Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook, delivered a sicha about his feelings, that what he felt 19 years earlier from the War of Independence. And this is a speech that is called Mizmor Yud Tet Shel Medinat Yisrael, right, 19. Mizmor Yud Tet. And what did Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook say? He said, Lifnei Yud Tet Shana, before 19 years ago, Beoto Laila Mifursam, Behigia Arza Hachlatatam Hachiyuvit, Shel Moshle Umota Olam, Litkumat Medinat Yisrael. 19 years ago, when that famous evening, when we heard about the decision, the positive decision in the United Nations to give part of the land of Israel to the Jews, Kishakol Ha'am Nahar Lechutzot Lachug Berabim Et Rigshei Simchato, when the whole nation rushed outside, and you should see pictures of 1948, May 5th, they dancing in the street. There are some famous pictures on Rehov Ben Yehuda. Really, what some people recognize today, you know, dancing and singing. Says Rav Kook, Lo yacholti lahashlimi manaseh. I wasn't able. I wasn't fully comfortable with what happened. Im ota b'sora no ra'ah. That awesome news. Why was I not so happy? He's telling this story 19 years later and what he felt back then. Ki achein nitkayem. Because what happened? Pasuk in Yoel, et artzi chileku. They took my land and they divided it. And I'm not happy. I can't dance like everybody else, says Rav. I couldn't. In those days, I couldn't dance like everybody else. And here are the words that give you chills. It is very famous words. Cain, this is what Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook said. Eifo chevron shelanu. You're happy? Where's Chevron? Ha'anachnu shokachim etze? V'heichan shchem shelanu? V'yiricho shelanu? Ayei, hanishkachen, we're going to forget them. V'chol eiver hayardin, shelanu hu? Kol regev v'regev, every single clump of dirt, kol dalet amot, kol chevel eretz v'kivrat adama ha'shayachim l'eretz Hashem? Ha'biyadenu levater? Afilu al milimeter echad mehen? Chalila v'chas v'shalom. There's a famous word that he said, Heicha, Eifo chevron shalanu. And what was fascinating is that Rav Kook's closest Talmidim didn't know what he was talking about. He had 19 years to share this story. He didn't share it in year 5. He didn't share it in year 10. He shared it in year 19. He shared it in May of 1967. They didn't know what happened. And then the Six-Day War breaks out 20 days later. People talk about that speech as having a level of, I don't want to say the word nevuah, but premonition. He didn't say it after 18 years or 17 years. 19 years, Rav Kook says, I'm not happy. I wasn't able to celebrate back then. And so I want to talk a little bit about what happened 20 days after that speech. Before I do, I want to put it in perspective one more time, and I'm quoting somebody, tremendous Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Chizkiah Levenstein, who was the Mashkiach of the Mir, eventually became the Mashkiach of Panovich. These were not capitals of, you know, Bnei Akiva Snifim, if you know what I mean. The Mir and Panovich, and he said these statements right after the Six-Day War. Rabbi Chizkiah Levenstein, what did he say? We're going to quote him in the beginning, we're going to quote him at the end. And I'm choosing him specifically. In a kuntris inyanim shishmiya marana mashkiach, that's quoted in Hatkufa Hagdola. He says like this, Ha'alef ba'et kazuhi. The number one thing that we've got to do right now is lehakir shezeh ma'aseh Hashem. What's going on in Israel, this is right after what we're going to talk about now, the Six-Day War. You have to realize this is ma'aseh Hashem. Lo mikre. V'lada'at, and we have to know. Shekol goralenu biyadenu. Ve'ein l'shum goreim hashpa al zeh. Eino! Nah, it's up to us. It's not an accident. God is giving us an opportunity. And ve'amru chazal, ein adam no keif etzba'o, ein adam no ge'a b'muchan. You know, the Gemara tells us that you can't even get a splinter in your pinky without God being in charge. Certainly, what's going on in Israel right now. Hakol b'hashkacha pratit miduk daka. Shum prat. Lo na'azov l'mikre chas v'shalom. Believe Toach Hashem. We have to believe in Hashem. We're not going to. Nothing that happened in the war that you and I experienced, he said, happens by chance. One more point. Avarnu milchama kazu nisim gluyim kol lochem v'sipuro. And I'm only quoting some stories that are more klali. The sefer that I'm quoting is Hatkufa Gdola. We have it here. Is this thick? And there's an entire chapter of specific miracles of this tank and of this plane and of this person and of this, and he knows these stories. Shamati sheyeshnam ka'ele shenihiyu shomrei mitzvot. After the war, he said, I heard, and this is absolutely documented, it was a huge kiruv event. V'nish'elet ha'she'ela. This is so amazing. And try to remember who's saying this. The Gevaldik Talmud Chacham Rav Yechezkel Levenstein came from the Mir, came from Panovich. And you got to ask the question, Lama etzli ve'etzlenu lo chal shinui. This guy's putting on tefillin for the first time. What's new about me? This lady's lighting Shabbos candles for the first time, the Shabbat after the Six-Day War. Why am I not changed? Ha'avodah hi la'asot ha'yidiyot l'kinyan ha'lev. What you got to do with this story is to make sure that your heart acquires it. It's got to stick. Ha'matzav nireh v'libi omer li shezmanim miyuchadim ba'im. Big times are coming, I feel. Rish'ei ha'goyim einam shotkim. V'gam ha'svara notenet sh'ha'borei lo asa me'orot pele she'avarnu. God didn't do these wondrous things. Kadesha ya'avru b'shigra. What does shigra mean? Shigra means yafem od, routine. God, look who's saying these words. God did not make this so that we can go through this in a regular routine. Ho-hum. Ha-borei rotze la'asot mashu. Ha-nisim ha-gluyim shira'inu lo l'chinam ba'u. It didn't come for nothing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu notein lanu litchazek be'emunah u'bitachon. We did this that we can get stronger in our emunah. Kedei she'al yedei zeh nuchal la'avor nisyonot u'mashberim v'tzarich chizuk. We're doing this so that we can successfully pass nisyonot u'mashberim, tests and crises. A mashber is a crisis. We need chizuk. V'Hashem yihyeh be'ozreinu. God willing, Hashem should be to help us. And I want to take this message and the next few minutes that we're going to share in learning what happened those days. I really want to take Rabbi Chizkiah Levenstein's words to heart. We're all going to have a great day today. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's a great day. But it would be a real shame if by the time today is over, you check off, been there, done that, what's the next thing, what's the next high, what's the next excitement, what's the next FOMO that I'm not going to miss. This is an opportunity, this is a springboard for something bigger. Let's talk a little bit about what happened. Okay, just looking at a picture of what the Middle East looked like right before the Six-Day War, and in your experience, you know, that we're a pretty small country, and we're surrounded by people who want us dead. It's hard to remember that on such glorious days, but it's absolutely true. What happened in the Six-Day War? So first of all, I want to introduce you to an expression that I did not make up. I believe it's Latin. Causus belli. It's acts or situations that provoke a war or justify a war. Now we're talking about May 1967. We're talking about three causes that started the war. It is true the first shots were fired by the Israeli Air Force. It is also true that the acts of war were started a month before that. Number one, after the 1956 Suez Crisis, Egypt agreed to the stationing of the UNEF, the United Nations Emergency Force, in the Sinai Peninsula to ensure that all parties would comply with the 1949 armistice agreements. That agreement ensured that the Sinai would not be militarized. Specifically, it's a huge buffer zone between Israel and Egypt. Obviously, you know, we talk about Yom Yerushalayim in the Six-Day War. Yerushalayim militarily was a tiny piece of the miracles and the events that happened in June 1967. So, number one, we have this United Nations Emergency Force that's a huge buffer. We have Israel, we have Egypt. Egypt's trying to kill us. Don't worry, we have the United Nations for whatever that means. Number one, in May 1967, Egypt expels the United Nations forces. If you're Israel, if you're the entire rest of the world, there's only one reason why you would expel the United Nations forces. But we're not done yet. That's number one. Number two, on the very same day, Egypt remilitarizes the Sinai. Causes belli number two. It's not enough that you expel the forces that are trying to protect me. You bring in your soldiers. You bring in your armor personnel carriers and your tanks and your guns and your planes. Number three, all within the span of a few days. Number three, 1 week later, Egypt closes the Straits of Tiran. Now the Straits of Tiran, and they closed it to all ships flying Israeli flags or carrying strategic materials. The Straits of Tiran were Israel's water gateway to the Red Sea, and therefore to the Far East and South Africa. It was Israel's primary source of oil. So now, the bodyguards, if you will use the expression, left. Egypt, who has been swearing to kill us before 1948 and since 1956, moves in their guns and their tanks, etc., and they effectively create a stronghold, a siege, so to speak, around the state of Israel. What effect does that have on Israel? Now, I want you guys, to the best of your ability, and I got to do this also. I did not live in those days. But if you have an opportunity sometime today, go to YU Torah and look up Rabbi Willig. You know Rabbi Willig Shlita. Rabbi Willig was a Shir Aleph American boy in Kerem B'Yavneh. And I'm going to share with you in a minute what he says, but obviously he says it 1,000 times better than I could. He was there, but you and I were not there. Let's try our best to put yourselves in the shoes of an Israeli citizen living after these three events happen, and in addition to all the other rhetoric. I don't need to tell you, I mean, we hear it today all the time, how many times Egypt and Jordan and all the other countries said, we're going to throw them into the sea, and we're going to go back to Haifa, we're going to go back to Tel Aviv. So now you are living in Israel. What do you have? Well, number one, you have to understand that Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Kuwait, Tunisia, Sudan, and the PLO, 12 countries and one organization, amassed troops all around Israel's borders. 500,000 troops, 2,500 tanks, more than 950 jets, combat aircraft. And who on the other side? Let's count them all. Israel. Okay, the odds are not good. Less than half the troops, less than a quarter of the tanks, less than a third of the aircraft jets, combat jets. Not looking good. What does Israel do? 10,000 graves are dug. You're sitting at home, your next door neighbor comes home from a day of work. Where were you? I was digging graves in Tel Aviv. 10,000 graves, body bags are ordered. This is easy. For sure 10,000 people are getting killed, easily. Soldiers, civilians, men, women, children. 14,000 hospital beds are ready. Anybody who was not deathly ill was sent home, because we need the bed, because thousands of people are going to be injured, civilians included. Preparations are made for evacuating Israeli children to Europe. We still had survivors who sent their kids away. You know, when they were in Poland somewhere, we got to send them away now. There were people who sent their kids away in the Gush Etzion area in 1948. We got to do it again. And this is like in the news, it's on the radio, it's everywhere. Going further, antidotes for poison gas are stockpiled. Of course, they're going. The enemies are going to throw poison gas at us. Absolutely. 20,000 gas masks arrive from Germany. It's also very powerful. Thousands of volunteers arrive from Chutzlar. Some of you may know people, grandparents or friends of the family. We need volunteers. Civilians dig fortifications and defenses. Put yourself in the shoes. There is definitely going to be a destruction. I just hope we hold on to some part of our country. There's no way we're surviving this. Families are going to be split up. Listen to this, a quote. There was, quote, a sense of approaching catastrophe, of the Jews' abandonment to yet another Holocaust. There was talk of widespread bombing of Israeli cities, of an entire generation of soldiers being wiped out. If you have a chance to read this book at some point, it is very, very detailed. If you have a chance to read the book, Michael Oren's 6 Days of War, highly recommend it. Again, it's very detailed, but a lot of what I'm saying today is based on that book or the quote or sources that he quotes. Sense of approaching catastrophe. None other than the Prime Minister himself, in a reply to a daily newspaper's prime minister, in a daily to a reply to a newspaper's question, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol predicted in Yiddish, blood will run like water. This was not General Nasser talking. This was the Prime Minister of the State of Israel. It wasn't the smartest thing to say right before a war. But he said in Yiddish, blood will run like water. And that is pre-war, early June, late May, 1967. See, the Six-Day War in Yom Yerushalayim is a happy day because we know the end of the story, but do your best for a few minutes to put yourself in the middle of the story before it actually happened. Let's move on. More preparations for war. What an Am Chacham V'Navon. Every time we mention people, you got to think of God in the back of your mind. What do they do? So first of all, Israeli pilots and ground crew train extensively in rapid refitting of aircraft returning from sorties, enabling a single Israeli aircraft to sortie up to 4 times a day, as opposed to the norm in the Arab world, 1 to 2. Israeli air forces are twice, if not more, quicker in flying, coming back, refitting, fuel, guns, bombs, etc., and going out again. They can go up to 4 times a day, as opposed to many Arab Air Force pilots that can do it once a day, maybe twice a day. Number two, IDF soldiers practice endlessly driving vehicles through soft dunes in the Negev. They discovered that vehicles would get greater maneuverability in desert terrain if tires were partially deflated. As a result, they could choose their angle of attack and advance through areas the Egyptians least expected. Every one of these is genius. It makes you proud to wear white and blue or green. Israeli army orders soldiers to be supplied with 1 liter of water every hour rather than the previous 1 liter per day. As a result, soldiers were able to perform better than their Egyptian counterparts. They're hydrated. It's the Middle East. You got to drink. Years earlier, Mossad agent, you definitely know this story. Mossad agent Eli Cohn infiltrates the highest ranks of the Syrian government. He provides crucial intelligence to Israel. For example, feigning sympathy. You've heard the story before? Yeah, feigning sympathy for Syrian soldiers. He ordered trees planted next to every single Syrian emplacement to shade them. I think they were eucalyptus trees. These trees were later used as target markers by the Israeli Air Force. Eli Cohn almost became the Secretary of Defense in the Syrian cabinet. And when the war breaks out, he radios Israel. You see a eucalyptus tree? Bomb it. Probably right next to it is a Syrian bunker. Eli Cohn literally gave his life, literally. His wife didn't know what he was doing. Read his story, Eli Cohn's story. He was married in Syria. His wife in Israel didn't know. And he did it completely, completely for you and me. He eventually was caught, and he paid for it with his life. He was hanged, and his body was left degradedly hanging for a long time. It wasn't only Eli Cohn. Mossad agents carry out surveillance on Egypt. By the time war broke out, the Mossad had either a field intelligence officer or an Egyptian informant in every single Egyptian airbase and military headquarters. Three staff officers of the General High Command headquarters were Israeli spies. Three people in the tiny group of people deciding where we bomb, where the Egyptians are going to bomb, where the Egyptians are going to attack, three of them were spies for the Mossad. It's Am Chacham V'Navon, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Going further. And now, it's time for war. Hashem Yilachem Lachem. Here's the story. I know the story, and I'm getting chills. It's incredible. Here we go. On June 5th, 1967, at 7:45 a.m. Israel time, the Israel Air Force launches Operation Mokade, Operation Focus. All but 12 of its 300 operational jets left the skies of Israel in a mass attack against Egypt's airfield. They left 12 jets on the ground in all of Israel. 290 of these planes fly out to Egypt. Forget Syria, forget Jordan, forget anybody else. Unbelievable risk. Many Israeli airplanes headed out over the Mediterranean before turning towards Egypt. Others headed straight over the Red Sea, attacking. What happens? Before the war broke out, Egypt's Air Force was on high alert. One-third of their planes were in the air, one-third of their pilots were sitting in their jets on the ground, and one-third of the pilots were resting. It was a rotation for a long time. It was very grueling. If you were, before June 5th, if you were an Egyptian Air Force pilot, you were doing one of three things every single day. You were resting, you were flying, or you were just literally sitting in your jet waiting in case you were called. However, by the time Israeli jets crossed into Egypt at 8:15 a.m., the one-third of the pilots who were flying had landed and were briefing the other two-thirds of the pilots who were about to take off. All planes were on the ground. What were they doing at the time? They were eating breakfast. Israel knew exactly when the Egyptian Air Force pilots were eating breakfast, talking. Israel comes in and does this. Meanwhile, the Egyptians, this is another miracle from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Egyptians shut down their entire air defense system at this moment. Why? Their soldiers were commanded not to shoot at any plane. It looks like an Israeli plane, I don't care. You may not shoot it down. Why? Because they were worried that their own forces accidentally would shoot down the plane carrying Field Marshal Abdel Hakim Amer and Lieutenant General Sidki Mahmoud, who were flying in the Sinai on June 5th at 8 o'clock in the morning. And they were so afraid, no, don't shoot down any planes because we might be in it. You can only press the trigger if one of these two people gave direct orders. Moving on. Jordanian radar operators operating one of the most Jordanian radar operators operating one of the most sophisticated radar facilities in the Middle East saw the incoming aircraft. They had seen Israeli planes before go out to the Mediterranean, but not in these numbers. And so from Jordan, they repeatedly radioed the code Enab, Enab, which means grape. It's the code word for war, and they were sending these messages to Egypt's general and chief of staff. They were screaming the words, Hodu Lashem Ki Tov. Why weren't those cries, it was the code word for war, why were they not heeded? The calls went unnoticed. The Egyptians had changed their codes the day before and had not yet notified the Jordanians. The Egyptians thought that Enab was the old code and they were practicing calling out the call for war. And so every Egyptian pilot is on the ground. Almost every Israeli Air Force pilot is in the sky. The Egyptians couldn't shoot down anybody even if they wanted to. And the calls for war went unheeded. Going further. The war continues. Listen to this, ladies. Hodu Lashem Ki Tov, Ki Le'olam Chasdo. Israel attacks Egypt's Air Force in a most unique way. They bombed the planes parked on the ground, but priority was given to bombing the runways. For this book, they interviewed an Egyptian pilot who was on the ground. And he watches these dozens of Israeli jets coming over his Air Force base. And he said, I remember thinking for a few seconds, these Israeli Air Force pilots managed to go all the way from Israel to here, and they are missing their targets. All of our jets, so many of our jets, on the first run through, were not even hit. How bad could the Israeli Air Force be? It took him a few seconds to realize that Israel was not aiming for the planes. They were aiming for the runways. You could have all the most sophisticated planes in the world, but if you don't have any runways, they are worthless. And this Egyptian pilot, if I remember the quote correctly, says, I quickly realized that my $3 billion Soviet-made jet was a very expensive beer bottle opener. All I could do was take my beer bottle against the wing and open a can. I couldn't do anything with it. How much to take off? So what Egypt prepared for was groups of people who can go out to the runways and repave them really quickly. Well, they quickly learned that to bomb the runways, Israel used a special kind of bomb called the Durandal bomb. It was developed secretly. Nobody knew Israel was doing it. It left craters 16 feet wide and 5 feet deep, and it also had delayed fuses that had never been seen in the world before. Delayed fuses on the bombs made repairing the runways impossible. The Egyptians tried to run and fill in these craters with cement, and explosions came out, and they said, we're not doing it. So then the next time around, Israel was able to bomb the planes. But the first few sorties were bombing the runways. That's one of the things that they learned in West Point. The strategy was a huge success, destroying virtually all of the Egyptian Air Force on the ground with few Israeli casualties. Oh yeah, that same pilot I was quoting before said all he could do was take out his pistol and shoot at these jets as they were flying by. The problem is that we don't see in the movies is that pistols not only shoot small bullets, but they're not even strong enough to reach the heights that the planes were flying at. It was totally useless. Over 300 Egyptian aircraft were destroyed and 100 Egyptian pilots were killed. Within two hours of the initial attack, Major General Mata Hod, commander of the Israeli Air Force, reports to the IDF Chief of Staff Yitzhak Rabin, quote, the Egyptian Air Force has ceased to exist. Hashem yilachem lachem. But the war is not over. It's only 2 hours. You have to give it a little time. Moving on. Israel maintained radio secrecy. Its population and most of the world was unaware for the first days of the war of their tremendous successes. Talk to anybody who was alive and old enough to know. You're sitting in a bunker with your little children and you're listening. There's no Israeli radio. There's no Reshet Bet, Reshet Aleph, Galei Tzahal, nothing. All you can do if you understood Arabic or English was listen to Jordanian or Egyptian radio. And Jordan was reluctant to enter the war, and Israel warned it not to get involved. But General Nasser of Egypt used the confusion to draw other countries into the war. You're listening to these reports, and the reports are We are marching on Tel Aviv. Our soldiers are dancing in the streets of Haifa. And you're sitting in Jerusalem. I mean, you hope you'll live. You hope there's some mercy that when they take you captive, nothing will happen to you. Tzvi Kotzebue was here a few minutes ago. He said it in five words, kind of briefly. He was a prisoner of war in Jordan for a couple of years. He said it, you hear him say that? And it's like, Chulti Beshevi, he said it like really quickly. That's the most you can hope for, that you and your children, because they're marching on Tel Aviv. They're marching on Tel Aviv. Israel said nothing. People have conjectured why they said nothing. But, so you're Jordan, you're Syria, and you didn't enter the war. And all of a sudden, you're hearing all the spoils of war is going to Egypt. All the glory is going to Egypt. And they were chomping at the bit. They were ready. They were ready. They were ready to go. When you listen to Rabbi Willig's Sicha, he will tell you, you'll listen and you'll hear him say, if you were driving a car from Egypt to Tel Aviv, you passed right past Keren B'Yavneh, the yeshiva Keren B'Yavneh, one of the earliest Hesdi yeshivas. Tel Aviv is also very early, one of the earliest Hesdi yeshivas. So if you're driving a car from Egypt to Tel Aviv, you pass right by Keren B'Yavneh. Rabbi Willig saw with his own eyes Israeli soldiers putting bombs on the roof of the Beit Midrash and the Chadar Ochel and the dormitory of KBY, so that when, not if, when the yeshiva is evacuated because of the approaching soldiers, we can explode these buildings and the army won't be able to use these buildings as a place to sleep and regroup and feed their soldiers. KBY was for sure gone on their way to Tel Aviv. This is what you're all hearing. We're all hearing in the first couple of days of the war. False Egyptian reports of a crushing victory against the Israeli army and forecast that Egyptian forces would soon be marching on Tel Aviv influenced Syria and Jordan to enter the war. You got to enter the war. That was a mistake, to say the very least. By May, this is a picture of Israel pre-1967, and this is a picture post-1967. By the end of the war, Israel had conquered enough territory to more than triple its size. The victory enabled Israel to unify Jerusalem and to capture the Sinai, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and what the world calls the West Bank. What we skipped is Jerusalem. But just, I'm trying to give you a scope of what it was like. The war, the miracles, the geography. Now, Jerusalem. The War of Independence in 1948 resulted in Yerushalayim, as you well know, as being divided, with the old city lying entirely on the Jordanian side of the line. The Kotel and Har HaBayit were absolutely, basically inaccessible. My uncle, Olav HaShalom, who my son Meir is named after, also learned in KBY long before Rabbi Willig, and he has a story, my uncle had a story, it's passed down in the family now, that he visited the Kotel when he was Shana Aleph. He didn't tell his parents, and a group of guys looked up, saw the Kotel for a couple of seconds from some kind of tower. They saw it, they mumbled some Tehillim, but the tour guide that had brought them there yelled at them to duck, and a sniper had shot where their heads popped up. Nobody got hurt. That was like a story. It's a very funny and cool story now. It was not so funny then. That's the best you could do with the Kotel. I'll quote Rabbi Cohn, the principal of SAR, one more time, twice in one day. He told us that when he was in YCQ elementary school, let me go to YCQ. There you go. When he was in YCQ elementary school students pre-1967, on Yom HaTzma'ut, they had an assembly. The whole school gets together. He was like in fourth or fifth grade or something. The whole school got together to listen to a speech, and he said he was spellbound by the speech, even in fifth grade, sitting on the edge of his seat. Who was the speaker? The speaker was some guy whose friend had seen the Kotel. This guy who was telling the most awesome story in the world, he didn't see the Kotel. Nobody sees the Kotel. But his friend did. And the whole story was about him, how he got to see the Kotel. You and I are going there today, singing and dancing, hopefully beyond there still today. Okay. That was pre-1967. During the late afternoon of June 5th, Israel launched an offensive to encircle Jerusalem. Israel launched an offense to encircle Jerusalem. The Jordanian defenders, who were heavily dug in, fiercely resisted the attack. All of the Israeli officers, except for two company commanders, were killed. officers gone. And the fighting was mostly led by individual soldiers, lower level soldiers. The fighting was conducted at close quarters, in trenches and bunkers, and was often hand to hand. After fierce fighting for 2 days, Israel gained the upper hand. However, fearing damage to holy sites and the prospect of having to fight in built-up areas, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan orders his troops not to enter the old city. He doesn't want to have casualties. He doesn't want to hurt. He doesn't want to damage major sites. However, upon hearing that the UN was about to declare a ceasefire, he changed his mind, didn't talk to anybody in the government, and he decides to command the troops to conquer Jerusalem. The fighting was conducted solely by paratroopers, Sanhanim. Israelis did not use armor during the battle out of fear of severe damage to the old city. You had tanks. There's one picture, a video of a tank trying to get into the old city, couldn't fit through the walls, and you see paratroopers climbing underneath it. Again, my son has the zechut of being a paratrooper, and one of the things that they did as part of their, before they were sworn in, is that he's in the same gedud, brigade, battalion, as the one that freed the Kotel, and so as the walk to get sworn at the Kotel, they followed the footsteps of their predecessors, literally, all the way through Shara Arayot. I had the zechut on Yom Yerushalayim, maybe today as well, to daven Mincha and Shara Arayot. It's the only time of year where I feel safe, and to do it today, Baruch Hashem, God willing, will be very, very safe. Okay, moving on. Reinforcements arrived. Commanders, that's the brigade I was talking about, 55th Paratrooper Brigade, Matzagur, radios his men. This is what he says. El Mifakdei HaGedudim, this is to all the officers in my brigade. Anachnu Yoshvim Al HaReches. This is a picture taken while he's talking. We're sitting on the overlook. Shetzofel Ir Atika. This is an Israeli soldier, a Jewish soldier. We are looking on Ir Atika. Ve'od me'at anachnu omdim li'kanes eleha. We're going to go in. Where? This is on the radio in the middle of a war. Ha'ir ha'atika shel Yerushalayim, shemeaz kol ha'dorot cholmim aleha v'shuafim aleha. We're going into the same Jerusalem that people have wished for thousands of years. Anachnu niyeh rishonim shenikanes aleha. And this is the hatankim shel Eitan mitkadmim mismol v'ikansu l'sharayot. It turned out they weren't able to make it in. Gedud 28 and Gedud 21 lanu el hasharet, start heading toward the gate. Gedud 66, go after them. Lanua, lanua, lashar, move, 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 move to the gates. Misdar siyum, listen to the confidence in the Amunah. Misdar siyum, we're going to have a roll call at the end. Yihyeh al al harechava lamala adkan avor. That's it. Over and out. Here we go. When the Tzanchanim enter the Kotel area, eventually in this hand-to-hand, fierce, heavily casualties battle. Rafael Amir, a Kol Yisrael broadcaster, went with them. We're going to hear him talking right now. This is the live recording, June 7th, 1967, of his experience. In the background, you can also hear the radio that was nearby broadcasting the soldiers' communication. You can also hear the commander, we just said his name, Matzagur, radioing his soldiers, Chadal, Chadal, Chadal means stop, hold fire. You're going to hear him telling them when the battle's over. We're also going to hear Chief Rabbi Rav Shlomo Goren, IDF's Chief Rabbi, reciting the bracha, Menachem Tzion Uvoneh Yerushalayim, while he blows the shofar. And here we are, we get a chance to see it ourselves.
חדר, חדר,
bayit biyadenu, hara bayit biyadenu, and with just that, and just like that, ladies, hara bayit biyadenu, here we have the most unbelievable victory, the unbelievable miracles, casualties, injuries, losses, and yet here we have what I think is so, in my mind, so emotional and so powerful. We have to remember exactly what we saw. But the story is not over here. I'm playing a little music in the background. It's one of my favorite songs. But I hope you'll understand why I'm playing it. Here we go. A few hours after the victory, an assistant paratrooper company commander named Menachem HaKohen takes a jeep to bring Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Cook and Rav David Cohn. Rav David Cohn was called the Nazir of Yerushalayim. He took a neder of Nizirut, the Nazir of Yerushalayim, and he goes to bring these two, Rav Cook and Rav Cohn, to bring them to the Kotel. They were delayed a few minutes since the Nazir had been in a Ta'anit Dibur and needed to find a Beit Din for Atar Nedarim. He had started Ta'anit Dibur in the beginning of the war, and they couldn't leave until he was able to get Atar Nedarim. Rav Cohn needed Atar Nedarim. After his visit to the Kotel, reporters asked him for his thoughts. Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen, what could he tell on these most emotional time of his life? What could Rav Cohn say? This is Rav Goren, this is Rav Cook, this is Rav Cohn. And reporters jumped on him and said, give us, what do you want to say? He says the following, Hinenu mudaim lekol Yisrael ulaolam kulo. We are telling Israel and the whole world, shebipkuda elokit, chazarnu habaita, b'ma'alot ha-kodesh v'ir kodshenu, u'mehayom ve'eilach lo nazuz mikan. The story gets better. Shortly thereafter, Rav Cook was asked in an interview. He had an interview with the foreign press. This is what they said. They said to him, if you had 10 minutes and only 10 minutes, not a minute more, to explain your position about Zionism in Jerusalem, what would you say? 10 minutes. We call this in the world today an elevator speech. 10 minutes. Of course, this is hours and hours and hours. But we have to limit you to only 10 minutes. What do you, Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Cook, think? Rav Cook smiled for a while, and then he said, "Elu teisha dakot yoter midai." You gave me 10 minutes, that's 9 minutes too long. Omar, I will say rak shtei milim. Chazarnu abaita. Chazarnu abaita. This is Rav Cook's quote that he had. The moment that he touched the Kotel walls. And we conclude again from the unlikely place of Rav Yechezkel Levenstein. Ba'et hazu yesh lanu limud leitchazek be'emuna. Hine avarnu zman. We went through a very hard time. Shebo ra'u bachush amitata emuna. We saw with our own senses the truth of our belief. Kirvat Hashem li'amo Yisrael melo chol ha'aretz kivodo. Kol yachid nimtza lefanav b'yashkacha pratit. This is what Rav Yechezkel Levenstein is saying days after the Six-Day War. V'chol zot b'ribui l'lo shiur shel ma'asim. It's just infinite number of stories. Miyom liyom noda al ma'asim osofim. Every day I hear more stories and more miracles. V'chaval, says Rav Levenstein, how sorry would it be? Shema'ora kazeh ya'avor aleinu bli sheninatzlu lekarev halev le'emuna. It was a message that was true 49 years ago, and it's true this very moment as well, ladies. What a, and I only touched the surface of the preparations of the fear, and also the Maaseh Elohim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu reminds us of, handed to us. And chaval me'od it would be if we don't take this opportunity litchazek be'emunah, to get closer to Hashem, to get closer to our people that are here, to get closer to this city. But it's not just this city, it's the whole country that benefited from the miracles and the efforts and the sacrifices that happened 49 years ago. And so this, in my mind, is the celebration of Yom Yerushalayim. It's dancing, yes, but it is the appreciation for the emunah that we have to have now, the appreciation of God's connection to you and to me as we progress today and tomorrow. And many of us are scheduled to leave this country at some point in the next month, and that's okay. That's what we're supposed to be doing, and we'll do that. But we will take a piece of Israel with us and a piece of Yom Yerushalayim with us, so that we are able to be closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just historically, but religiously and spiritually, in Mirtz Hashem. Chag Sameach, everybody.